The headlines: Iran's leader says countries can turn sanctions into a tool of empowerment by tapping into their national capacities. Iran says it is high time the U.S. made its decision in response to Tehran's initiatives on the revival of the 2015 deal. Also, oil prices jump after European Union leaders reach an agreement to ban 30% of Russian crude by the end of the year. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says world powers are weaponizing sanctions against other countries, but such bans can be crippled by focusing on domestic powers and capacities. In a meeting with the visiting Tajik president, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said that Iran has made good progress in various fields, not just despite, but also because of Western coercive measures. The leader said Tehran and Dushanbe can expand their ties much further than the current level, and the relations must undergo fundamental transformation. Elsewhere, Ayatollah Khamenei called for the formation of an inclusive government in Afghanistan, stressing that Iran and Tajikistan are both concerned about the spread of terrorism and Takfiri groups in the region. For his part, Emomali Rahmon also called for the improvement of Iran-Tajikistan ties. He said his country seeks peace and stability in Afghanistan, ruled by a government with the participation of all ethnicities. University professor Fawad Azadi says the leader is sending a message of resilience to the U.S. by downplaying the impact of sanctions amid talks to revive the 2015 deal.
Well, I think the section of Ayatollah Khamenei's speech on sanctions had two purposes. One, it's customary for world leaders, when they meet, they share experiences, both positive experiences, negative experiences. So this is an achievement of Iran to be able to grow become a leader in many scientific fields at the same time that the country has been under sanctions. So that's the number one reason. It's an ordinary thing to do. I think the second reason Ayatollah Khamenei talked about sanctions is with regard to what's going on with JCPOA. As you know, the United States government, the Biden administration, is basically following the Trump lead when it comes to Iran. Biden is basically implementing Trump's policies, and the negotiations are not going fast anywhere. So the message, I think, the second reason this issue is raised is to give this idea to the other side that Iran can live with sanctions, and Iran has been able to overcome difficulties. And the basic message is that even if the United States wants to continue that policy of sanctioning Iran, it may actually have some benefits in the long run for the country.
Iran says the latest reports by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency on its nuclear activities are unbalanced and unfair, according to Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh. The reports repeat the same errors that existed in the Director General's briefing to the European Parliament. He added that even the agency has admitted to those flaws before. Khatibzadeh noted that the IAEA should avoid politicizing its reports under pressure from Israel and other parties. Also, on the efforts to revive the 2015 deal with the P5 plus one countries, the spokesman said that everything now hinges on Washington's decision and its response to Iran's initiative. Khatibzadeh said what Iran needs more than anything now is guarantees of its full economic benefits from any agreement. He said other details, including the U.S. blacklisting of the IRGC, will have to be decided at the negotiating table. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage showing the seizure of two Greek tankers in the Persian Gulf over maritime violations. The video shows IRGC's Hellebore Special Forces boarding and taking control of the Greek ships. The vessels were impounded on Friday. Shipping sources said one tanker was carrying an oil cargo bound for the U.S., while the other was heading for Greece. The incident came weeks after Greece impounded an Iranian-flagged oil tanker and delivered its cargo to the U.S. The Iranian Foreign Ministry summoned the Swiss and Greek envoys over the issue. Switzerland represents U.S. interests in Iran. The ministry slammed the U.S. violation of international law and maritime conventions governing free navigation and trade. It also demanded the immediate release of the seized ship and its cargo. Oil prices are seeing a rise over the European Union's decision to cut two-thirds of Russia's oil imports into the bloc. In early deals, Brent crude reached a two-month high of $122, while U.S. West Texas Intermediate reached $118 per barrel. EU leaders have agreed to ban oil imports from Russia as much as 90% by the end of this year. The embargo affects Russian oil imports via sea, but pipeline deliveries will be exempted. The continued pipeline purchases is meant to allow Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic more time to trim Russian supplies. The embargo is part of the sixth package of EU sanctions on Moscow since the beginning of the Ukraine war. The head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, is in Rome for an official visit. During his trip to Italy, the prominent Iranian cleric met with Pope Francis and members of the Shia community. Max Civelli has more from Rome.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. The prominent Iranian cleric presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Maybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Arafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Arafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Arafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Damascus slams Ankara's plan to establish a safe zone in northern Syria as an act of aggression and an extension of Turkey's ethnic cleansing policy in that area. Syria says the measures taken by Turkey over the past few days have caused civilian casualties and have done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages. The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said last week that his country was planning to establish a so-called safe zone along 30 kilometers of its border with Syria. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty. People in Gaza have protested to drum up support for thousands of Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails, especially administrative detainees. Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say that they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes. Rashraf Shannon has more in this report.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The United Nations has warned that in Afghanistan, 1.1 million children under the age of 5 will likely face the most severe form of malnutrition this year, as increasing numbers of hungry children flow into hospital wards. Rahmatullah Bagban has more from Kabul.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses, rents, treatment, and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil, or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid. Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Official data shows that Germany's inflation has set a fresh record as the war in Ukraine pushes already high energy and food prices up even further. The preliminary data from Federal Statistics Agency, Des Statis, shows the country's annual inflation reached 7.9% in May. It marks the highest since German reunification in 1990. It is also the highest reading since 1973, when mineral oil prices increased following the oil crisis there. The Statistics Office attributes the current rise in inflation to energy prices. It says the war in Ukraine pushed energy prices to over 38% in May, year-on-year. Food prices also increased by more than 11%. The office also blames supply chain problems due to the coronavirus pandemic as another factor pushing up inflation. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about the events which led to Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we try to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. This time, you will hear on the events after the Imam's arrest, particularly the historical uprising of June 5th, 1963. Stay with us, please. Thank you. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest was like a big blast in the country, as the people of Qom, Tehran, and other cities poured to the streets to protest against the Pahlavi regime's move. The demonstrators chanted slogans like "Death to the Shah" and "Either Death or Khomeini." In the holy city of Qom, people swarmed around the imam's house and chanted anti-regime slogans. The tyrannical regime, in order to intimidate the people, flew military planes over the city, but angry people became more persistent in their move and called for unconditional release of their great leader and source of emulation. The agents of the Shah, scared of the spread of anti-regime sentiments, opened fire and massacred hundreds of people. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest caused people from all walks of life to demonstrate across the city. University students closed their classes and poured to the campuses in protest. Owners of different occupations in bazaar closed their shops and poured to the streets. Students spread their rallies to the streets and joined the people, demanding the imam's immediate liberation. The regime security and police forces tried to control the city by cannons and tanks. In Tehran, too, hundreds of people were massacred by the bullets of the mercenaries of the Shah. In the evening of June 5, 1963, Tehran was plunged in silence. Trucks were gathering the bodies of martyrs to take them to cemeteries. The whole city was full of soldiers to suppress any protest. The people in the small city of Pishva near Varamin in southeast of Tehran created a great epic as they heard the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest. These people, most of whom were farmers, started marching over 20 kilometers toward Tehran while they were wearing their shrouds as a sign of preparedness for death. They chanted slogans like, "Khomeini, Khomeini, you are the son of Hussein. Either death or Khomeini," and "Death to the Shah." Moreover, the people of regional villages joined the marchers and shaped great masses in Varamin. Thus, the people of Varamin also joined the demonstration marching toward Tehran. Almost at sunset, they faced the military squads of the tyrannical regime, Bagherabad village. Seeing the stiff resistance of the people, the military forces cruelly massacred thousands of innocent people and injured thousands of others. People in Qom had gathered around the imam's house. The imam's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, relates, "The sound of either death or Khomeini and Khomeini, Khomeini, may God guard you, may your bloodthirsty enemy be dead," had filled our home. The sound came from the street, but it seemed to come from behind the door. Our home was the venue of ladies. They would come and faint. I would put their heads in my lap and restore their health with water and juice. They were the wives of the poor seminary students and classes who really loved the imam. Imam Khomeini's wife, referring to the taunting of a few women affiliated to the regime, continues, "But at the same time, some women would come and break our hearts with pungent remarks, yet we had decided to keep calm." Comparing the women who would faint with those who would taunt us was the comparison of poverty and courage with richness and compromise. Imam Khomeini's wife points to the horrible atmosphere of Qom and the regime's flying of military planes over the city on June 5th, saying, "On June 5th, the regime had ordered phantom planes to fly over Qom to intimidate people. Women and men in Qom had become scared of breaking the sonic wall in the city. It seemed that the planes would fly low when they reached our house. They would maneuver with queer speed over the city, and this would deteriorate the condition of most women in our house. So I and my daughters would give them juice. They had come to soothe us, but it was we who were soothing them." Lady Saqafi continues on the self-sacrifice and resistance of people in those days. "People went on a stiff strike and closed all shops for 15 days. At last, the government forced the people to open their jobs and shops through intimidation and burning some shops and demolishing big stores. Of course, upon my elder son Mustafa's opinion and permission, bakeries and butcheries opened for a few hours in the first days to meet people's needs. Fruits had gone bad in shops, but nobody would open. Honestly, people showed high self-sacrifice and resistance." She continues, "Near the sunset, there was a rumor of attacking our house at night to captivate women. This rumor made men think over replacing us. Mr. Ishraqi and Mustafa asked for replacement. I told them, 'Are you scared?' They said, 'We have heard so.' I said, 'It is false. I won't leave this house. I am ready for captivity, but not escape.' I resisted, but Mustafa was anxious and angry. So I accepted unwillingly. We went to Mr. Ishraqi's house. God knows how it was hard for me, but I tolerated. We went and came back the day after to see that I was right."
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As the war on Ukraine continues, so does the economic damage to the world, like EU countries. While many EU countries come out and say Russia has to be sanctioned, they are not united when it comes to sanctioning Russian oil and gas. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Ukrainian conflict, the Russian advancements militarily, the U.S.'s continuing militaristic approach, and how Kyiv is refusing to give up any territory to Russia. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. The Washington Bureau Chief at the Executive Intelligence Review, William Jones, joins us from Leesburg. Also joining us is political analyst Frank Emspach, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines.
featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. If I may first start with you, Frank Emspach, and one of the top developments coming out of the EU leaders' meeting, which occurred, is that they are not united on the issue of sanctioning Russian oil and gas. And that obviously shows the need that they have, not only for the energy that Russia offers, but at the same time that they still are keen to continue this war. And the question that comes about now is, this war has been going on for 3 months. It doesn't sound like they have found alternatives suitable enough to meet their demands. What is how do you see this situation when it comes to their efforts, saying they want to sanction Russia, but obviously failing to do so in this area?
I think there's several types of positions. There's the one about where some of the countries are dependent upon oil and gas, Germany, Hungary. There are people who have a political agenda, for instance, Turkey, who's made it very clear that they're opposed to Finland and Sweden joining NATO because of their support for the Kurds. Then there's internal political issues beyond that, where the Europeans are getting increasingly uneasy based on their statements about whose objectives we're actually fighting for here in the Ukraine. An absolutist one of the Ukrainians, there'll be not an inch of Ukrainian soil. The American ones, which is even more extreme, our goal is to weaken Russia to the point of practical collapse. Or the European one, which says we want to have some kind of settlement that'll guarantee Ukrainian sovereignty in the future, but we understand that parts of the Ukraine here, like Odessa, the Crimea, have been part of Russia for 500 years, so there's a basis for settlement. You have three different objectives there, and they're mutually exclusive. And then I don't believe they have reached consensus on those. And, of course, that fuels the differences on sanctions.
William Jones, the three objectives that our guest Frank Emspach talks about, which ones do you think is the one that they're going to perhaps agree on, if you think that those are the three objectives that are out there for them to decide on?
Well, obviously, the ones who are controlling this thing are not the Ukrainians themselves. It is the British and the Americans. I emphasize the British, the statements coming out of Liz Truss and Boris Johnson, that we see here the British Empire being revived by the Biden administration. And on the ground, of course, in Ukraine, you have all these British SAS players on every level. And the Ukrainian president, I don't think, makes a statement unless he gets that statement from the controllers. He said a lot of contradictory things. And I think the contradiction is not simply in his own mind, but it's the different signals that he's getting from the people who are backing this thing. You're going to see more and more of this dissension. It's a situation which cannot be maintained short of going into a major war, which is always a real danger here when you're dealing with really a conflict between nuclear powers. That is, the U.S., which is the key player on the Western side, and Russia. But I think there's so much dissent, as the other speaker mentioned, France and Germany, who have been the major forces in the EU, have now been kind of overshadowed by a combination of the British, who have gotten a revived sense of so-called global Britain, and the East Europeans, who are just obsessed with this idea of Russia. The Poles, in particular, are playing a major role here, and I'm sure they want to enhance their position in Europe by demanding stronger moves against Russia. But it's an existential situation that they're facing. that you have the obvious split in the EU right now over the oil, even more so over possible gas boycott. But as this begins to hit, as the prices continue to rise and the people in France and Germany and in all of the European nations begin to see the cost of living shoot to the top, you're going to have people on the streets demanding a change here. So I think it's what we're seeing with the meeting today is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the divisions that exist here, which I think will really end this whole thing. What the end result will be in Ukraine, I think Russia will not be moving from any territory anytime soon. And I think you're going to have a very lengthy political process being played out in which there is no clear solution for months and maybe for years. But hopefully the military action right. will stop. It will all go to the diplomatic negotiating table.
Frank Hemsbeck, William Jones talks about the inconsistent statements coming from Zelensky. Just hours ago, Zelensky said Ukraine will fight until it gets all of its territory back. 3 days ago, he said, stop playing with Russia, end the war. Ukraine Zelensky to the West, Russia-Ukraine war, criticizing, I'm reading a headline, criticism of the West has mounted in recent days as the EU moves slowly towards a possible Russian oil embargo. This is 3 days ago. This is what the headline read. Inconsistencies in Zelensky's statements. Is he getting orders from the control room, and who is controlling that control room?
Well, I think the United States is the dominant arms supplier and the dominant cash supplier at the moment, and we have a very extreme position. I think Zelensky is caught in a variety of different ways. The rhetoric is one thing, but he had that the Azov battalion, which is now, of course, all captured, but their political force is still very much strong, very strong in Ukraine, and they've made it clear that they'll overthrow him before they agree to any kind of truce. So you've got internal political pressures on him and external ones, and so I think that he's going to go back and forth. My guess is that Henry Kissinger, of all people, laid out at Davos, and he got no publicity about this, at least in the United States, or very, very little. He said, here's the deal. The Russians will keep the Donbass and probably the land between Odessa and Crimea and the Crimea, and that's the settlement. And everybody understands that. So that was his position. And I thought that was very interesting that the European press picked that up actually quite a bit. You have in the French press a real, real clear, at this point, offensive against the expansion of NATO or against these militaristic things. So I don't know what's going to happen. And clearly, a position that says Russia will give up Crimea and eastern Donbass is simply a non-starter. That's not going to happen unless the Russian government is overthrown in some fashion. Maybe that's the United States' objective, but if so, then you're really risking a world war. And I know there isn't anybody other than people who are waving the flag here and to the extent in Ukraine who are actually partisans of that.
Do you think that's the objective of the U.S., William Jones? And are Europeans on board?
Well, they certainly are not on board. And I think there's a lot of dissension within the United States itself. Judging from a recent interview by Colonel Richard Black, who was now retired, a former state senator in Virginia, who went out publicly warning that this was like 1914 if we continue in that direction. He's gotten about, I think, 600,000 hits on his YouTube site and a lot of messages from military people, both in service and out of service, saying, congratulating him on taking this position. State Department, of course, wants to control the narrative. That's why they're trying to crack down on this. That's why the U.S. press didn't really cover the Kissinger statements, because the State Department wants to control this narrative of going to war, because they know the opposition that exists here. And that's really, I think, the one reason to be optimistic in this is that you're seeing tremendous amounts of opposition to this insanity as we're approaching closer and closer to a conflict with Russia. And I think the fact that the economic sanctions and the moves against Russia are leading to massive inflation here in the United States, which may become incontrollable at a certain point, you're going to see the kind of mass upsurge in Europe and in the United States demanding an end to this insanity. But at the present moment, the administration here in the U.S., with the definite backing of their British friends, are pushing hard to make this into a major conflict. They hope, I'm sure, to try and, you know, push the Russians back. I don't think they're going to be successful, and I think they can. It creates a very dangerous situation, but I think it's going to start to fall apart because of the internal dynamics working here, which are against the populations of both Europe and the United States.
Well, to use William Jones' word there, Frank, MSPAC insanity, it seems like the U.S. did not step into that frame of mind, Joe Biden, that is, when it decided that it's not going to, I guess, allow for these rocket systems to be sent to Ukraine, which would reach Russian territory. Why do you think the U.S. decided on that?
Because I think people within the country and people within the Congress and people have some sense who say that nobody wants the kind of conflict that's going to develop. Look what happened when Biden said, look, our new defense perimeter is the middle of the Formosa Strait, you know, and we're going to defend Taiwan militarily. People all over the world suddenly said, oh, my God, you know, we can't, this is crazy. We're not going to do it. And he forced to at least verbally walk back. The problem that you've got here is that I think Biden mentally is sort of where Harry Truman was. He's basically a Cold War Democrat, and he feels that you have to be aggressive, stand strong, and keep the rhetoric up and so on and so forth, because they're afraid of being attacked by the right, by the Republicans. And I think that framework is not so prominent anymore. And what are you going to say, that the Democrats are communists? That's not going to work. So, you know, there's a mental framework here that's very dangerous. And it's a danger that is basically, if you have a $700 billion defense budget, just like, you know, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail, to, I think, increasingly the sort of mindset of American diplomacy and direction is that it's all military. Look at what we're doing around the world. You can't separate our position on China from Ukraine and from the sort of bellicose position here. There's been no willingness on the part of the United States publicly, and I suspect privately, to even begin to say, what is it going to take here? What is the cause of this? You know, we may not understand it here, but, you know, to people in Europe, they say, gee, you know, NATO used to have 17 countries, and now it's got 30. Gee, you know, in 1990-91, Bush and the Secretary of State Baker said to Gorbachev and to Yeltsin and others, well, we're not going to expand NATO, and blammo, you have a hostile military force on your border. Well, what does that mean? And there's been no willingness on our part, it seems to me, to really recognize what an existential threat the Russians see in that.
Uh-huh.
And everybody is on edge, and I believe a very dangerous situation.
William Jones, do you get the sense that there's been a little bit of a lull when it comes to military assistance to Ukraine? I mean, I'm going back a couple of weeks and maybe further than that, when you had almost every other day the U.S. making an announcement that it's going to assist Ukraine militarily. It was $5 billion or $20 billion, or I think the last one was $40 billion. And, of course, the EU countries always making announcements of military assistance. But now you're really not getting it. I mean, I'm looking, for example, at the piece of news about how Germany is being blasted, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, coming under attack for not sending Ukraine enough weapons, for example. Of course, the most recent stance on military assistance came from France with its new foreign minister, Catherine Colonna, who said that Paris is ready to boost military aid. But Zelensky is asking for it. It's not really getting it, it appears. Do you think that there's a little bit of a pushback on providing military assistance to Ukraine?
Well, I think the assistance that has been given, the $40 billion that's been promised, I assume that's going to go out there. But I think there's resistance also within the Congress. look, this thing is going to is having a massive effect on the U.S. inflation rate. We haven't seen the last of it, and on the price of oil and gas, as well as on the price of food. So when they see when the American people, and here we're going into election in November, which will decide the fate of the House and the Senate, and is going to really put the clamps if the Republicans make a lot of headway here on the Biden administration. And here they see American people see $40 billion going out to Ukraine, and they're asking themselves, hey, what about our bridges? You know, what about our roads? When is that going to happen? At that point, this becomes a reality in which Biden has to react politically. If he cannot come up with solutions that satisfy the needs of Americans, they're going to vote against him. They're going to give him a more difficult time after the congressional elections, and that will also probably play into the presidential elections. And I assume that Biden is also attentive of this situation, and maybe that causes a little bit of a back down on some of the weapons going in. I also think that there is a certain understanding somewhere in the mind of the president that at a certain point there's a red line, that if weapons go in there that that can really penetrate into Russia, can be used to attack Russia existentially, then you are in the danger of nuclear war. And I hope that's foremost in his mind rather than back of his mind. May have a play a role in the decision making now.
Well, in the sense of when you talk about nuclear war, this economic chokehold that it has put countries not only within the EU, but also the U.S. itself, Frank Emspach, is devastating people. I mean, we're looking at, for example, German inflation to hit 8.7%. Now, they haven't seen that since the 1990s. Looking at EU...
thing about inflation, because it's still part of the historical memory, what happened after World War One. So thus, they're very upset about that. I would just differ a little bit on the inflation issues here. The day the war started, the gas prices go up. Well, we had plenty of gas, you know. So part of it is also a manufactured issue here, which can be dealt with. But I think worldwide it's a problem. And one of the things the Russians said the other day, which was in the European press, I did not see that in the American press, but I might have missed it, is that they said, how about a humanitarian thing and we'll ship grain? And we said no. So, you know, there's those pressures as well. But I agree. Once you start putting offensive weapons in Ukraine, however they get there, you then basically set the stage for a escalation. And I think that you cannot have a situation that's stable when you've got a missile 5 minutes from your state, from your national capital, that can obliterate it. And I think that the Russians have been very clear about that for the last 10 years in terms of NATO and the Ukraine in particular. And I think that's fundamental to their policy, just like we feel this way. We got upset, you know, when the Cubans had this missile crisis 50, 60 years ago, you know, and never mind having, let's say, Russian forces on the Canadian border. We would be hysterical. And I think that we need to have that thing and that understanding. And what's missing really in this political climate in the United States is what I would call a progressive and relatively widespread peace movement. That's gone. You have a conservative-led movement that's much more isolationist than, and the 12 senators voted against aid, I think it was on Wednesday. So there is a bloc in the Senate who is not up for this, you know, but we'll see how that works. But politically, the inflation has got to be dealt with. It can't be dealt with on the backs of everybody here. Boris Johnson made the move yesterday to undercut, or 2 days ago now, to undercut the Labour Party by putting this excess profits tax on the oil companies. Well, that was quite a move. The conservatives fought that tooth and nail right up until they got the polling results on Thursday, which point they instituted it. So maybe we'll see some things like that happen here. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, we're quickly running out of time. When we take a look at this conflict or the war, William Jones, the repercussions are so wide. And it's not just about the EU, and it's not just about the U.S. we're talking about countries around the world that are suffering. And when you really take a look at the types of warnings that are coming from different types of organizations, whether it's the IMF or whether it's the Food and Agriculture Organization or a host of UN organizations that are saying, listen, there's going to be riots in countries that can't afford right now to feed their people. There are people in Africa that are not able to feed the malnourished there. Problems similar to this, which are erupting across the world. But when you look at who's leading the offensive here, it's the U.S. and, of course, NATO member countries. Do you think that there's going to reach a point where the brakes have to be put on forcefully on the U.S. and the EU, where countries are going to rise up and say, you guys got to stop with this war, let's reach a diplomatic solution?
I think it's already happening now. I mean, if you look at the situation, Russia is in a difficult situation, but they're working economically to get themselves out of that through other arrangements, not based on the dollar, not based on the dollar system, both with China and with many other countries. So you have actually the formation of alternative financial systems given this crisis. And of course, the crisis with the outflow of funds to the military and the pressure on the dollar, it's really the dollar is losing its role as an international currency. So there are certain fundamental systemic changes taking place as a result of this. And I think because it has gone so far, reaching the point of almost, you know, nuclear threshold, you have other people both in Europe and the United States, but also in Africa and Asia, Latin America, who are saying we've got to move in a different direction. And that different direction is not that the United States is the leader of the world and determines everybody's policy, but that the major countries of the world, including the big countries, including okay. countries like China, India, Russia, have got to come together to discuss the solutions for mankind as a whole and not go into this kind of a Cold War mentality.
Thank you very much. We're fresh out of time. William Jones there, Washington Bureau Chief, the Executive Intelligence Review. Many thanks. Also, Frank Emspach, political analyst, who spoke to us from Madison. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Yigal Tawei and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode. And you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, in which we shall discuss some very controversial issues. Well, without further ado, I would like to go directly into the main of discussion. But before that, I would like to introduce my guest. Welcome, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm so happy to meet you here again.
My pleasure.
So here with us, we have Dr. Karimi. And in this episode, we're going to discuss some debatable questions. So stay tuned. Okay, for today's episode, the question circles around a very controversial issue, which is suicide. Which we see a lot of it in these modern day, which is a busy day of living. We hear that many people take refuge in suicide and find the best solution to their problem is to cut it all off. So why do people go for suicide?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This question can be answered from different dimensions, and especially when it comes to psychology. But here we are not going to talk about, I mean, the psychological issues. So we are mainly concerned with the advices given by our religion and our prophet and the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam in this regard.
So according to Islam, why people go to suicide?
It seems that, of course, Islam gives a lot of, some advices for the people. It seems that one of the main reasons for people committing suicide is disappointment. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can, include all the reasons for suicide in this one word.
Exactly.
Disappointment.
The point which God many times in the Holy Quran has asked us not to be disappointed.
That's the point. And that is why we are going to share some of the verses and narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam to be away from disappointment and how to be hopeful for the future. It's been mentioned by Imam Ali alayhi salam that the greatest calamity is disappointment. This shows how great this calamity is, to be disappointed of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and of your future. Again, Imam Hadi alayhi salam says that optimism decreases your grief, which is one of the ways through which we can remove disappointment. And we have a lot of books written about the effects of optimism.
Which now, is, of course, very difficult, and you have to work on it.
That's
it's
the
not
point.
Just saying it
yeah.
and it's done.
Yeah, what we are saying today is in theory.
Yes,
but, of
exactly.
course, I will refer to some practical ways, but it needs a lot of work. And as you rightly mentioned...
A hard work, of course.
Exactly. In our day and time and in our eras with all these problems and difficulties, sometimes, some people come to this point that this is the end, and they find the last resort to be suicide. But
they find themselves at the end of the rope.
Yeah. And so we are trying to say that, yeah, it doesn't happen all over a night to take rid of all those
exactly.
difficulties. It will happen gradually speaking. So we may just give a couple of tips taken from the verses and narrations mm-hmm. to get rid of this disappointment. Now, according to the scholars, one of the ways to change your attitude toward the life and the difficulties and problems is just to be thankful. Again, it is difficult, but one of the ways is to think about what you have and what others lack. And this is very important. So that is why we are highly encouraged that when it comes to worldly pleasures and properties and wealth, you need to compare with those people who are below you, who are lower than you in terms of wealth, income, and so on and so
yes,
forth.
Yes, there's always this thing that people say to each other that when you focus on the things you don't have, you will lose the things you already have.
Very interesting.
Which is
yeah.
peace, which is health, whatever.
And that is why we have the concept of shukr being emphasized on a lot in our narrations. And shukr has this psychological effect.
Which means
to
being thankful.
Being thankful. Oh Allah, I thank you for whatever I have. So it's very important that we do it on a daily basis, early in the morning before we go
yes,
to sleep.
Yes, to devote a time for that, to
yeah.
count your blessings.
Yeah. So when early in the morning you think about all the blessings that you have and many of which, other people lack, it will give you a kind of hope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to some extent, it would remove that disappointment. So, in this regard, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives a blessing to a person and that person thanks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in his heart, before that person utters his thankfulness in his words, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will increase his blessings. And this is a sunnah, a tradition of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.